It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, this is Virginia. Events over recent years have highlighted racial inequalities across the globe, and Australia is not an exception. Here at Broad Talk, we recognise that the path towards true reconciliation is the responsibility of all of us, all the time. In that spirit, we acknowledge the traditional owners of the country on which we record this podcast, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging.
The system is broken.
I don't get the rules at all.
How far can we work within a system that we need to get rid of?
I think men feel somehow women's liberation is a threat to their manhood. And it is.
Tragically, I couldn't give a shit whether you think I have a right to speak up about anything or not.
People who make revolutions get burnt.
We started it here!
Maybe, you know, I've got some sort of crazy speak up about it mental illness.
Change takes time. Do you have any regrets?
No.
Hello and welcome to Broad Talk, the Changemaker series. I'm Virginia Harsiger, and it's lovely to have your company for this very special series that we're bringing you in partnership with MOAD, the Museum of Australian Democracy, housed here in Canberra in Old Parliament House, where I've had the wonderful, pretty amazing honour of being guest curator of a new exhibition on Australian women changemakers. So in this series, we're diving into the personal stories of some of those outstanding women, both young and old, and spanning a very diverse range of backgrounds. And while their stories are incredibly different, there is a consistent theme, and that is courage, amazing courage, and I guess what I like to call guts. And to each of these women, I ask about the moment that fired them into action. We talk about the challenge, failures along the way, their source of inspiration. And also, we touch on the issue of cost. What does it cost you to be a big change maker, to put yourself out there? So stick with us for this series as you're in for a feast of raw and real and very inspiring stories. Now, you can download Broad Talk and a new episode will drop into your feed each Friday. And reach out, let us know your thoughts. You can email us at hello@broadtalk.net, Broad Talk, of course, all one word, or find us on Insta at Broad Talkers, Facebook at Broad Talk, or you can find me on Twitter most days at Virginia_House, HAUSS. And we've also got a little website now, broadtalk.net, so you can drop into that and subscribe to the newsletter, and I'll send you an occasional update on what's happening, perhaps even share a little bit of, you know, what's playing on my mind. But now, Mary Crooks. Mary is the executive director of the Victorian Women's Trust and a very well-known trailblazer. Mary's someone who came into my orbit when I was a pretty young journalist working in the Victorian Press Gallery. Back last century, back in the 80s and 90s. Oh, the early 90s. But Mary was one of those women I saw as being a really ballsy, feminist, pioneer, one of those sort of ballsy women that Victoria seems to have been very good at producing and nurturing. But unlike some of our other women change makers who really push out alone, Mary has always struck me as someone who is renowned as being very focused on the collective, working with groups, consulting widely. And consequently, she's never really stood out in the spotlight on her own. Mary Crooks, welcome to Broad Talk.
Thank you, Virginia.
It's so lovely to have you along. And look, I want to kick off by asking you, was there ever a moment or a single event in your life that really activated or deepened your resolve to do something, to change something?
Look, I think probably the standout event for someone in my late teenagehood was the Vietnam War, to be honest. It was being still at school as a secondary student at a convent where the nuns didn't seem overly perturbed about the war and the carnage, and I was struggling to hold on to my Catholic views. I was struggling with the fact that the Catholic Church seemed to be silent on the morality that lay behind the Vietnam War. So I think that was a real turning point because I challenged it at school. I incurred the wrath of some nuns who thought I was being incredibly, you know, treacherous of the Australian cause. Mm. And I got to Melbourne University, you know, not long after that, took part in the first moratoria and just was able to find a voice other than being a schoolgirl alarmed about it.
Mary, what about at home? Were you having those sorts of conversations with a sort of a social justice ethos back at home?
Very much so, Virginia. My mum and dad neither of them was tertiary educated. They both went through the Depression. They were incredibly smart people who didn't have the fine touches of a tertiary education. They were, you know, in lots of senses, you know, more intelligent and smart than a lot of people I've met along the way, to be honest. And we had lots of conversations around our humble home in Haywood at that time. And it was an interesting tension. We'd have these conversations at home with my mum and dad on the war, on Tory government, on social justice. And then I'd go to school and find that, you know, I was hearing contradictory views. So there was this little tension in my teenagehood that I think left its mark on me.
Tell me a little bit about those nuns, though, because they obviously had quite an impression on you, as for any of us who have gone through an education with nuns, as I did too. It leaves a very strong impression.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I don't want to be down on it so much, but there were some remarkable women who were my teachers who were nuns, and there were some less remarkable ones. But I think it was the context was really not so much about the nuns in the convent, but the oppressive religion dimension to it that I realised in my lifetime since that I think I'm quite possibly a fairly deeply spiritual person in a lot of senses of the word, but I had become increasingly impatient and irritable and angry by formal religion as expressed in, you know, the Catholic religion especially.
You went on to actually, in your professional life, to do some work with nuns or former nuns and some advocacy work and mediation. What was that about?
Well, that was quite a remarkable little project, actually. Out of the blue, often is the case that in my work at the Victorian Women's Trust, you get desperation calls from women. And one such call was from a woman who had been a former religious, and she came to me and I listened to her story. And, you know, it was heartbreaking, really, having spent so much time for her order, unpaid, of course, and not well supported. But when she left the order, having made a terrific contribution, she was left with nothing. There was no departure policy or practice in place. And she had a lot of mental health issues and difficulties and relative poverty ever since. And that just struck me as a very unjust, a really unjust situation. And so I said to her that we couldn't actually help much on the material front, but we could research it. And so we went out and we listened to many, many stories from women and men, I might add, in monasteries and other male orders. And we published the research called The Paradox of Service.
Mm.
And what I didn't realize at the time, Virginia, is that that was actually, it appeared, the first time that the lid was lifted of this question of men and women who had given enormous amounts of personal sacrifice in the aim or, you know, with the focus on religious life. And when they couldn't sustain that vocation and departed, they were just subject to the most inhumane of treatment at an ethical and practical level. I thought that was quite shocking. We set up at the Trust without a budget. We set up our own little independent advocacy program, highfalutin name. Myself and two wonderful volunteers, Susan and Hillary, we trained ourselves up as arbiters, and we listened to these former nuns' stories, or Hillary and Susan did most of that legwork, and we ended up going into bat for those women because they were so damaged, so traumatized by what had happened to them that there was no way known they could have re-entered the front door and made a plea on their own behalves.
Mary, that first nun who came to you was actually very lucky that she did and that she found you, because of all the change makers I know, you are the sort of person that would respond in that way of first and foremost going out and finding the information and consulting and speaking to others. I want to ask you about your methodology, because ever since you became executive director of the Victorian Women's Trust in the mid-90s, as I said in the beginning of this, you have really focused on collaboration. It's a real participatory democracy sort of process, kitchen table conversations. Why do you believe so much in bringing everyone together to collaborate and consult?
For a number of reasons. It's a really good question. Before I came to the Women's Trust, I had, in fact, a number of very, very substantial opportunities at the time of the Kayne government in the 1980s.
You were a policy advisor for Premier Kayne, weren't you?
Well, initially, when he was Shadow Minister for Planning, I was his researcher and speechwriter, which was a phenomenal experience because I feel as though I learnt a lot of my political ethics from John Kayne himself. Mm. You know, he was one of a generation, in my view, and a very ethical person. But I went on to, on his watch when he was Premier, I chaired the inaugural Youth Policy Development Council, which was the first of its kind in Australia. I went on to chair the Social Justice Consultative Council. And they were all they were fantastic opportunities for me to put into practice what I think was largely an intuitive response on my part around collaboration being the best ethic. But I think, Virginia, that the transformative experience for me was when I was appointed to the Brunswick-Richmond Powerline Panel, which sounds in this day of energy crisis really weird. But essentially, to cut a long story short, the two men and myself, we resolved an issue that had been boiling away for well over a decade, unresolved, parliamentary inquiries, all sorts of things thrown at it and unresolved. And we resolved that in a matter of 18 months. And we found a solution that had in fact existed a decade before at lower cost, I might add.
Mm.
But we had found a solution that would have saved a decade of enmity, of poisonous relationships, of behaviours that in the end weren't furthering the common good at all.
Is your point, though, that you managed to come to that point because of the consultation process that you adopted?
My point is that I took, behind the scenes, I took the prominent role on the panel of designing the public processes that would underpin the Powerline Review Panel. It was something that the two men involved, they were terrific in their own rights, but this was not something that attracted them. So I designed the public processes. I designed the processes that brought the protagonists together, making them behave in front of one another and listen to one another and so on. And so the point is that because we resolved it, I then set about to think, well, why did that divisive issue remain unresolved for so long to the detriment of community?
When, in fact, it was resolvable if you brought two parties together in a way that got them to talk.
Absolutely. So it just spelt a big, flashing lights to me of if we can get our public processes right, we just can be far more efficient and effective, and we can resolve complex and vexed issues on behalf of the public.
So tell us a little bit about the Purple Sage Project, which you started in the late 90s, and kitchen table conversations. And I want to preface this by saying, when I first heard about the Purple Sage Project and the idea of going out to literally thousands of people and getting them to organise small groups to sit around a kitchen table and have conversations, I thought, and this is being quite frank here, I thought as a young journalist that was just waffle, that was potentially going to be just a big waste of time, and that the wonderful thing about feminist groups sometimes was sullied somewhat by women spending too much time talking. Now, that's a really bold thing to say, but it's true.
No, that's what I thought. And you weren't the only one I picked up on. There were various other journalists who thought it was a bit of a twee kind of thing. You know, in fact, so my point is that when I came to the Trust, I had, you know, a fairly substantial experience in being able to design public processes. The Coot Island fire was another example. So I knew, I had a deep faith that good public process can work. So I hadn't put it out there in lights. I hadn't trumpeted it. I just knew. So when I got to the Trust, in part, I actually threw my hat in the ring for the job at the Trust because three women, Angela Munro and Sandra Hart, and I had lunch as friends in the winter of our discontent in 1996 because we saw the rampaging privatisation agenda of the government at the time, and we were distressed, and a lot of people were distressed, and we sort of thought, what can we do? And we decided to come back in a month's time with our plans for what could we do, because we were just three solo women. I came back a month later to the same lunch spot and I said, I know what I'm going to do first. I'm going to put my application in for this job at the Women's Trust. Mm-hmm. And Angela and Sandra just thumped the air and said, yeah.
Was that because you saw that as a vehicle that would allow you or help you or enable you to do the sorts of things you wanted to do in public policy, but particularly in women's policy?
You've absolutely nailed it. It was the fact that we saw that the impacts of that policy agenda under that government were very stark on women especially. We had no platform as three individual women. I needed a platform. We needed a platform to do it. I felt justified in being able to put in a case to support my job that the Women's Trust needed to step out of, I put it more politely than this at the time, but I felt as though the Trust hadn't realised its potential. I felt as though it hadn't really looked at all the ways it could get out there in the public domain for women. And so it was a perfect coming together of factors.
You just said something really important, that you needed a platform. Can you just, I understand what you mean, but I find, particularly because in this series we're speaking to a range of different women and some very young women who've created their own platform. They have become the platform, I suppose. Talk to me a little bit about that. I mean, how important it was for you, well, we understand how important it was for you to have a platform, but is that really necessary, or can one just push out and do the sort of work you were doing by creating your own platform?
I think creating your own platform has very significant downsides to it. I think when I say creating a platform, it meant for me that I could have the legitimacy of formal collaboration, that I could have a board that would hold me accountable, that I could use the institutional status of the Trust to talk to donors, to support projects. I felt as though it would give me a legitimacy to engage with stakeholders, so that it wasn't, I was no longer an individual. I was actually the executive director of this organisation with an idea for a statewide collaboration. So it gave me an authority and a relative gravitas, not to you at the time, but to others.
No, it did. It did. I mean, I was very impressed, but also, yes, I guess being a cynical journalist, questioning.
But I think Virginia, a lot of it comes down to. I mean, I have a personal maxim, my own definition, for example, of independence. To me, independence is spreading my dependency around as many people as possible. And I think
I love it. I love it.
In a formal structural sense, I mean, I can have talent and experience and know how to do things, but the best comes out in me when I am surrounded by good people, strong people, accountabilities, and so on. And I thrive in that kind of environment.
Well, what happens, Mary, when you don't have that around you and when those around you haven't got the same drive as you, the same high expectations as you? What happens?
Well, I think, I don't know. I don't know in my own personal circumstances because we've always had a very small team at the Women's Trust of really passionate and talented and dedicated people, mainly women. And because we are totally reliant on donor funds, I think there's a certain pressure to keep the faith and to actually perform above expectation. And we have punched above our weight the entire time for a small outfit. So I don't know what failure looks like from that point of view, but what I do know in watching some other women at times who can be just wondrously passionate and focused on change, but unless they actually build a base and can take people with them, the chances of burnout and losing momentum and even failing, those chances are heightened. I think it's all about trying to take people with you and to build a really strong team around you.
That's such an important point. I want to come back and talk a little bit more about that and also your extraordinary work with Julia Gillard and for Julia Gillard at the worst of her position, her time as Prime Minister. But we're just going to take a quick break and back in a moment.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back. And Mary Crooks and I talking about the value of having a good team around you and behind you and the danger of pushing out on your own. And as I said, I also want to talk about Julia Gillard, Mary, but just elaborating on that potential for burnout. You, unlike other change makers, you don't seem to have experienced that. I mean, you have been going literally for, four decades. I know you're in your early 70s now, but yeah, about four plus decades, and you don't seem to be showing any sign of slowing down.
No, on the contrary, I can't see myself slowing down. I can see myself, needing to disengage from the trust to allow new leadership to take over, but that won't mean I'm retiring. It means I will re-engage elsewhere. I just can't imagine not being engaged in doing stuff that improves community and society and so on. So, yeah, I have a lot of energy. I'm a high energy person, but I have my flat times. But I think the thing that people don't see, Virginia, is that I'm actually much more introverted and reflective than people recognize. I've had to be more extroverted in my job at the Trust, but I like nothing more than time to self. I have been frustrated at times, even in my marriage, that, you know, I need to deliberately find time to myself, even though I have a great partnership. And the thing is that if I didn't have that thinking time, I would not be able to do what I've done. It's just that people don't see that side of me.
So how do you manage to quarantine time, space, to give yourself that time? I mean, are you very rigid about when you will work and when you won't?
Look, I can't. It's interesting. I consider myself, in the best sense of the word, that I stalk things. I know, stalking's got a terrible name, and so it should. But I am constantly mulling over things.
Mm, same.
About, when to make a decision and what the decision is. And, my staff in the past would roll their eyes when I'd come and say, I've just thought about that again and I think we need to do this. So to me, course correction, if you talk to the staff at the Trust and you said, tell us about course correcting, they would laugh and roll their eyes, because to me, course correcting is not about managing chaos. It's actually about all the time refining your judgment and settling on something that will work. And course correction comes from mulling, from stalking something, from giving it that private time.
Does that mean that you are also saying to yourself and staff, that didn't work, or this isn't working, this pathway is not working, therefore we will redirect?
Absolutely. I formed my own model a long, long time ago of purpose, aim, objectives, methodology, product and outcome. It's a model that is missing in a lot of the tertiary textbooks, and it's just second nature to me.
Mary, I've just come up with what I think you need to do when you do pull back from the Trust a little bit and move on to something else, as you just said, your words. The book. We need the Changemakers Guide to Surviving 4 decades plus of advocacy work, I think, because you've got the methodology. You've got the methodology down pat. But look, I'm being a bit facetious when I say that. I don't know if you'd want to do that. But I do want to ask you about Julia Gillard, because this is interesting in that back around 2012, 2013, when she was having a very, very difficult time as Prime Minister, you did some pretty extraordinary things. You were very and you, when I say you, the Victorian Women's Trust was very vocal and demonstrative in its support for Gillard, which was interesting because you've always tried to be pretty apolitical, but you went as far as doing things like publishing full page ads that were commentary about her or supporting her. Mm. I think we called it giving credit where credit's due. Tell me a little bit about why you took that stance.
Well, and I remain proud, Virginia, of the fact that the Victorian Women's Trust was the only organisation to step out there in the public realm and defend Gillard when she was Prime Minister. Now, we could afford to do so because we are independent. We're not apolitical, but we're not aligned because, utterances and advocacy and whatever is always political. But when Gillard became Prime Minister, we thrilled, along with a lot of women and men, to the fact that we had our first female Prime Minister in our history. And look, it was almost as though the day after, the week after, I detected that the ambience had started to change and that the attacks, the subtle attacks and the misogyny started to expose itself. And I'm hazy on the dates, but I do remember going to my board and saying, this is what's happening. Are we going to be the kind of feminist agency that wrings our hands and sucks our teeth and says it's terrible, or are we going to do something about it? And the board agreed, and they gave me license to start to research and write about what was happening at that time. And so I wrote and we published a document called A Switch in Time, which unpacked not just the misogyny around Gillard, but it unpacked the fierce and unwarranted attacks on the minority government at the time. And it also unpacked, because we'd done a lot of work around women and water, we unpacked the fact that back then in 2012, Australia had all of the major cornerstones in place for a halfway decent response to climate change with the work of Ross Garnaut and others. We unpacked all of that in A Switch in Time to show how much was being destroyed before our very eyes and to depict the extraordinary double standards around Gillard and men who are in that position. Unpacked it all. And because of that, it was interesting, our office was inundated with feedback from women and men about A Switch in Time. It was as though we had lanced a boil, to be honest. And we were party to an amazing amount of feedback from people who were feeling so aggrieved and discombobulated and angry and powerless about what was happening before their eyes.
But Mary, did it change anything? Because what happened in well, if we're to look back, and it's all very well being clever with hindsight, isn't it? But what happened in the political climate really was that things spun out of control and got worse, and we saw that under the Morrison government.
Yes.
So A Switch in Time, whilst it gave people an avenue to voice and articulate their frustration and despair, did it make any difference?
I believe it made a huge difference. So, for example, because I felt we had a window into people's feelings and sentiments, which the mainstream media wasn't picking up on, which is why when Gillard was looked like going into an election in 2013 as Prime Minister of a minority government, and we saw Rudd circulating circling.
Circling.
But,
like a shark.
And circulating. But I had said to the board again, look, we need, as an agency, we need to decide, can we pay a tribute to her leadership as Prime Minister under these destructive circumstances? Can we endorse her leadership going into the election without looking as though we're endorsing the ALP? Because I think we need to. And we had decided to do that, and I'd raised funds from donors to do so. And then when Rudd was circling, I thought, well, we can't just take out this one-page advertisement, credit where credit's due. We can't take it out if she's defeated by Rudd in the caucus, because it's just wasting donors' money. So, again, I took myself off for a long walk, Virginia, mulling over this, and came to the conclusion that we could do either of two things. If she survives the attack from Rudd and goes into the election as Prime Minister to govern in her own right, then we will propose a toast to her leadership as a feminist leader. Mm. If she gets defeated by Rudd, we will turn it into a tribute to her, to pay tribute to her leadership. So we did that. Those ads published in The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald reached an estimated 9 million readers.
Wow.
Our office was deluged for weeks. Virginia, we had men and women on the phone in tears. We raised a further $7,000 just from little people's money. The first donation, $200, from a 92-year-old World War II veteran called Max, saying, "Thank you, ladies."
Oh, wow.
We had the same ad translated into Greek, Italian, and for Kevin's sake, Mandarin, and we published it in ethnic newspapers. The point is that we saw into the sentiment of millions of Australians, women and men, through that ad. And so when you talk about impact, that ad in particular, I think, had enormous impact. It was audacious. People even come up to me still and say, "I remember reading that ad, credit where credit's due." And I think we articulated what millions of Australian men and women were thinking and feeling.
Well, sorry for interrupting, but yeah, you did. And you're also so ahead of your time, though, that it I hesitate to say this because it's not a criticism, but it kind of stopped at the border in that, you know, I'm situated here in Canberra and I think sometimes we have a bloody force field around this place, but it kind of didn't penetrate as far as the parliament itself, even though you were the first to really, as you say, lance that boil that exploded, I reckon, in 2021 with public discontent.
I think that the May the 21st election just gone, I think that's been a slow burn over the last decade of women's engagement, lack of engagement, disquiet around federal government in particular. I think that the 21st of May election in large part is a story about women's discontent and marginalisation in public policy terms over the last decade especially. I think the kind of outpourings we saw over credit where credit's due told us that there's a significant population of women and men, I might add. We had incredible feedback from men, and it taught us back then, or it reaffirmed for us, the enormity of men and women being able to work together on these gendered feminist issues, because there were a lot of Australian men who were very, very ill at ease with the treatment of Gillard. We saw the misogynists, we knew about the trolls, we heard it, the unparalleled attacks in Parliament itself, but there was a huge reservoir of goodwill towards Gillard, not just her the person, but to her as a female prime minister. And I think it's terribly important to work with that reservoir of goodwill.
It reminds us too, in what you're saying, that these processes do take time. And because, yes, it was a slow build, as you said.
Well, I think the important thing, Virginia, is that, and I've just written a little blog piece for the Trust this week, that after the Brittany Higgins rape allegation and after the Marches for Justice last year, you know, only in April, March, April last year, that it's a little known fact that the women's vote, the women's support for the coalition plummeted straight away. Remember the then Prime Minister Morrison saying, We were lucky we weren't shot,
yes. Yeah. And also that the failure of the then Minister for Women to show her face or turn up or say anything was
and
just
what they didn't realise in that Canberra bubble is that women have been carrying a quiet fury all of their lives, you and me and just about every woman, because we've suffered in different ways at the hands of entitled patronising patriarchal male behaviour. And women notice this and it builds. It builds and then it manifests. Mm. Now, the vote for the coalition plummeted in March, April last year and it never recovered. It never recovered. And I said months and months ago that Australian women will be the factor that largely drives the change in government in 2022.
And how right you were. We've just seen it in the 2022 election.
You could read all of the signs because we've known through our work around climate change, through our watermark, through the monster climate petition years ago, we've known that all of the big ticket issues that have cut women up are around integrity, around asylum seeker cruelty, around climate change, around the disdain shown towards the Uluru Statement from the Heart. We've been reading that lie of the land really closely. So, you know, it was an example of women changing government, in my view, and the mainstream media may not pick up on that very much. Doesn't matter, because I think the fact is...
The public did.
Yeah.
Mary, in the short moments we've got left, I want to ask you about anger. Because and this is really on the back of what you've just said, that slow build of fury and anger and I think just despair over the treatment of women. But you yourself, I want to drill this down to the personal. You yourself, I know, have at times been the subject of attack, as any woman in a public role like yours is at some stage. But you've said things such as anger is to be transcended, and you have commented on a time when you have felt white hot anger, and you've also said that you've been on the receiving end of some vicious undermining by other women. So tell me, how do you manage your own anger?
Well, there's no simple answer to that, Virginia, except to say, as a couple of, you know, guiding rules, one can't stay in a place of anger, to me. Anger is a legitimate emotion. It's a totally understandable emotion. But in my view, you know, and it's just sort of my own folksy wisdom on things, that nothing is gained by staying in a place of anger, that it must be transcended, not to be whited out, not to be repressed, but to be embraced, and then you have to process it for what to do. What to do in a way that is productive for yourself and productive for others. All I know is you can't stay there being angry. So you have to actually find a way to process it and to be able to move on to a point of doing stuff that is actually constructive, built from the anger and is constructive.
And when you've been personally attacked, as you have been at times, your style of management at the trust has been attacked, and also your decision to do some public events, or one in particular I'm thinking of where you did a Q&A with a woman who said some very controversial things. Yes, about, yes, Julie, who takes a controversial position on transgender women, yeah, and other issues. And you came under a hail of attack for that. But how do you not take that personally?
Well, you do take it personally. It's not possible to feel attack like that without it being impacting on you personally. But you can't stay there. That's my point. And you have to try and understand the attack, and you have to, I mean, when I was attacked, about 6 years ago by a group of women who actually rallied after we had sacked a staff member, and they used that as their cause célèbre, and our hands were tied. We couldn't speak about it publicly. But the attack on my person and my ethics and my professionalism was 100%, and I nearly went under. I certainly nearly went under at that point within, you know, a six-month period. I felt, you know, as a country kid attending those fairgrounds, you know, with the you'd take the guns and, you know, shoot the duck, and the duck would, the pellet guns, you know, and the duck would fall away, but then it would come up again with pellet marks all over it. And that's how I felt. I felt as though I was, really just about submerged. But again, Virginia, because of my own ability to think what's under attack here, and to know my truth, that was important. But also, I had a great partner supporting me at home, great female friends that I could talk to about things. I had great support, and I just don't think that you can survive these situations unless you have, back to my definition of independence, unless you have people where you can be totally honest and call out for support and avail yourself of support. But you have to know your own truth, and you have to stick with that truth. If the attacks that came at that time had any element of evidence and truth about them, I would have responded differently. I would have handed in my resignation. But I knew it was
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Wrong. And people who knew me and all the staff who worked with me knew it was wrong, and we stayed fast. It hurt, it was damaging, but I was steadfast.
Mary, it's been so wonderful talking with you. I wish we could talk all day because there's so much more I'd like to ask you, but it has been really fascinating. And
well, I realised also, Virginia, we got ourselves sidetracked about Purple Sage and the whole that whole collaborative ethic, because I didn't get to talk about how Purple Sage was the beginning of what to me is ultimately a feminist view on how you do public process in a society.
Well, yes, and
another time.
Well, another time, but also one that I think, and I was going to touch on, that I think we have seen, or we're seeing, move out into the wider community as a result of the Teal Independence, etc., and the Voices movement, which I know you've been part of too. That style of community collaboration has taken off much more broadly. But you know what, Mary, we'll have to do more at another time. But it's been so, so lovely speaking with you, and I appreciate enormously your giving us this, being so generous to give us this time. And I look forward to further discussions, and thank you for being part of the Changemakers, Australian Women Changemakers exhibition and series.
No, and thank you, Virginia, and good on you for doing it.
Oh, look, it's an absolute honour. It's a complete honour to be doing this. And to all of you who've stayed with us to listen to this particular episode, thank you. And I hope you join us again for the next one. We've got some amazing women throughout this series, and so, so much to learn. And I know I feel like I'm learning a great deal. So thank you for joining us. And don't forget, you can contact us anytime at hello@broadtalk.net or Virginia@broadtalk.net, and let us know what's on your mind, and do subscribe to that newsletter, and I'll get in touch with you every now and then. But in the meantime, as I say each week, don't forget, keep talking.